We're discussing the process of creation. The verses that we described yesterday mentioned that Maharsh Parikshit, he had already understood that there's a cause, that there's a creator of the creation, because he made specific statements about that. He wanted to hear further about the creator by understanding the process of creation. So from Janmad Yasya Yataha, from the source of all emanations, various energies are coming. So how are those energies working to produce creation? This is review, but Prabhupada went into the whole situation of he was using the example of electrical energy, and electrical energy drives things. It makes fans spin, and it makes cars go, and or engines start, and electricity cooks things and cools things. It's one energy that does so many different things. So one may not understand how that energy is working, and thus electronic devices or electrical energy may be mysterious how it works things. But even beyond that is, where does the electrical energy come from? Like with creation, where does creation come from? And so Prabhupada is paralleling that question with modern conception. I'll read how he says it. Foolish people say that the creative energy is independent and acts automatically as electrical energy works. Sound familiar? It's called the mechanistic view of life. And the mechanistic view of life says there's two things. It's actually one thing, but two things is there's matter and there's the laws that govern matter. There's nature and the laws of nature. And that's all there is. Right? And anybody, anything, however complex some portion or aspect of life is, it can be reduced to energy, matter, and the laws of matter, laws governing the laws of physics. Everything can be reduced to mathematical formulas. And that's all there is. Now, what's the implication of that? Let's dwell on it for a few minutes. What's the implication of that? Let's say it once again. From in public education, certainly here in America and in India as well, science says, and everyone, in order to get to where you are, you have to have had lots of science. Of whether it's under the name of science, it says what that that basic idea. So not only off to the side, but like out the window and in the garbage can, is any idea of anything else. It's just not factored in the education process. There's matter, and there's laws that govern matter, and anything can be described according to matter and the laws of matter. What's the implication? That's a question I'd like you to answer. What's the implication? In practical terms of, you know, when you go about campus and when you see life and deal with other people, what's the implication? You thought about it? Take a couple guesses, just like a wild stab at it. The person sitting next to you, what's the meaningfulness of that person's existence? Completely expendable. There may be some sentiments that says, you know, you should respect other people and value other people, but really, when you get right down to it, what's really going on here? Matter and laws of nature, governing matter. That's all that's happening. It's all that is. And groups of people and nature and animals and birds and all these sentimental people that go around, you know, save the whales and extinction of species, wars, and really doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. That's the implication. It may not be explicit. That's the implication. What's there of meaning? What's there of value? Whatever people want to put up there and say that's of value. Whatever it is. But who are those people? Bunch of matter and governed by the laws of nature and emotions and feelings and desires. Just a bunch of matter and the laws of governing matter. That's all it is. Sentiment kind of superimposes on top of them. What's sentiment? It's just matter and the laws governing matter. Face it. That's reality. So, how, you know, then ethics or anything, laws or relationships or that's science. That's what science, I mean, Nobel laureates express this explicitly. We're just a machine. And we can make machines that can replace these machines. And we're working on it. And it's not just science fiction. There are people that are working on it. Well, science fiction may take it into, you know, a futuristic thing. But there are people, a few people, the scientific community. You know, they're serious about it. And they got a lot of power. Power over the minds of people that go to universities to learn how to be smart and make a living. You know, the implication may not be explicit. The implication is clear. If you think about it. So all the humanities of, you know, sociology and ethics, how to live one's life, systems of government, law. It's convenience. It's impelled by the laws of matter, survival. In one sense, we can say, Prabhupada speaks, this is very naive. Because where do we find any machine that comes into being without a person making the machine? But then the assertion is, well, the person that made the machine is also a machine. Meaning just matter and laws governing matter. There is no soul. There is no God. That's silly. For that matter, there isn't even mind. That's just electrochemical impulses that fire synapses in our neurological system, and then we feel pain. But all it is an electrochemical event registering in brain cells. It's, you know, reducing things to that plane, that platform. Consciousness? Well, quantum mechanics and things want to say that it does matter how you look at things. So, just wanted to bring it home a little more relevant to what your lives are about. Because, you know, the implication of science is affecting the quality of life. And conversely, understanding this process of creation affects the quality of life. Besides, you know, which is it? Which is the reality that's the real picture of reality? The quality of life. One time it is at stake. Significant, and thoughtful people will understand. While we're speaking about, was it this way or that way? Was it just atoms got together by the laws of nature and formed organic monomers and polymers and got together and formed amino acids, got together and formed life, and next thing you know, you got a human being over millions of years. But all it is, and that's what's out there. You know, it's maybe studying some piece of it, but that's the picture. Life's meaningless. Very expendable. Grab as much as you can. Well, you can't, because again, it may not be explicit, but it's implicit. Quality of life really doesn't matter. Just enjoy as much as you can. Get a good education, get real smart, get as much as you can. And you know, if you want to go through life trying to not hurt people, that's good. Because, you know, you feel good about it, and that's nice that you feel good about it, but it really doesn't matter. The people that don't do things that way, that doesn't matter either. You know, that's not the value system that you hold, but that's the implication. So there's, like, you know, a good reason to look at, very thoughtfully, look at another model, because that's what is being provided for us here. But the statement that Prabhupada is making in the purport is that Maharaj Parikshit has already understood that there is a creator, and the creator creates through his various energies. So what is a manifestation of the Creator's various energies in varieties of ways. So he wants to understand, how does he do it? The process. The title of the chapter, The Process of Creation. And as we ended yesterday, if you can understand better about the process of creation, it's very awesome. It inspires, wow, awe and reverence for the Creator. Therefore, you know, there's some implication. Again, for a thoughtful person, if here's a very, very great person, and before this very great person, I am very small, the implication is I should do something. It's just a natural response. Let me do something to serve this great person, the supreme person. I should serve him. If one's heart is not crooked, if one's heart is, Prabhupada makes this statement that spiritual life is simple for the simple and difficult for the crooked. If I'm crooked, here's a great person, let me see how I can get rid of them. Or somehow bring them down at least. Or push myself up. Because I don't want to just accept they're great and I'm small. But the one who does accept that God is great and understands from yesterday how great God is, therefore I should serve him. It follows. At least for a person who's straightforward and simple-hearted and not crooked. Prabhupada said like this, Krishna consciousness is very simple. God is very great, I am very small, therefore I should serve him. That is Krishna consciousness. So how great is God? Therefore the mechanistic view, and that's the, you know, the modern way of looking at it, mechanistic view, a Vedic way of looking at it is the the modern scientists haven't really created something new. A new view of life is, it's as old as existence. And one of the ones who packaged it very nicely is Kanada. And it was called the atomic theory, I mean the English translation, where it's the best of the basic building block of everything is the atom. And what is life? It's just a combination of atoms that get together according to laws of nature. Hey, that's what the mechanistic scientists say. And that's what Kanda said, and it's essentially an atheistic view. So I'll point it out to you one more time. We have all been spoon-fed atheism since we were little kids. Over there somewhere is theism. And that's however much your family and the community that you grew up in gave you theism. But in school, how many hours in the classroom have you spent? You know, add up the number of hours each one of us here has spent in an academic environment where it's the mechanistic view. That's it. There's nothing more. If you want to learn something more, you go to the church or temple or place of worship, but that's not really the story. The real story is this one over here. And so we have these parallel things going on, and then you get in the way that the quality of life is being passed on to the next generation. And now you're, you know, in graduate level of your education, and where's God? And where's value? I know when I grew up, we went to the temple and we did some worship, but all that's missing over here. And what's right? Maybe you're not asking those questions, but explicitly to yourselves, but it's worth thinking about it. So the exercise that this chapter is going to take us through of understanding the process of creation in a it's quite scientific, it's quite logical, step by step, the unfolding of the energies of the Lord till we get what we see today. But before we get what we see today, there's lots of prior steps of unfolding, from subtle to more gross forms, and then varieties. Very complex. And the mystery is not going to be solved by taking the complex and like sticking a probe and seeing what moves. You know? It won't work that way. It's not discernible that way because it's the science is very subtle. There are persons that know, they're mystics that know the subtle science, and they can move matter without even, you know, without moving their hand, just by manipulation of subtle laws. But that's also mechanical. Where do the laws come from? Where does the matter come from? Where does the knowledge how to manipulate those laws come from? Where does this all come from? How does it, so what's the process of its unfolding? That understanding, it's very dangerous for that understanding to go into the hands of an atheist, because they'll just take this is how the process works and try to exploit it. Yes? Highly technical research in the hands of an atheist is very dangerous. Something very powerful in the hands of a fool is very dangerous. So, I don't know why I'm doing this, but you know, explicitly, that's the path you're being led down. Figure out how it works. God's out of the picture. But we want to have nice, peaceful society. That's not what you get. You get very highly technical, you know, people that I know that are involved in nanotechnology. What's it all about? War. Now, what are really micro ways of moving around and, you know, blowing people up? Then it'll go out into the marketplace where they'll have, you know, medical technology will improve because they can send things into people's bodies and find out what's going on and fix it. And, you know, great. Save bodies. But for what? They can pay more taxes, they can do more war technology research and blow more people up. Because, you know, we want to control. Maybe I should go back to the text. I'm not really happy with the atheistic education of today. It's very dangerous. A thoughtful person should understand, hey, wait a minute, what path are we going down here? What's at the other end of this conveyor belt? I won't get off this conveyor belt for just a minute. At least, like, hit the pause button and consider, where are we being led? What are the implications of all of this? And what about that religion thing that is out there somewhere that we never talk about over here? How come they never talk about it? And do people in religion also understand all these subtle laws and how the whole thing happens? And since they have a picture that works and it leads to quality life, I think I like that one. Doesn't mean I have to not take a responsible position in the education arena, but I want to be involved in the education. I want to be involved in my life where I'm like tuned into reality and a clear understanding of where it's going to take me. It's a little extra work. It's worth it. I'm being asked when I go to, from here I'm going to Dallas, Texas, and I'm being asked to present something at Southern Methodist University, SMU, on leadership, a spiritual perspective. So part of what I'm speaking to you is, you know, having to sit before some Southern Methodist University people, professors, and they have a whole, it's the humanities, the chairman of certain departments that studies, I don't know exactly what they study, but things to do with how values can come into society and, you know, social, softer issues, social issues, social political issues. They're going to get some of this energy from me. You know, but what is it? It's a religious college, Southern Methodist University. I would say some things if this wasn't the recording. So I'll save it. But leadership requires seeing, you know, having some vision. Where are we going? Not just being part of the pack that just follows, but out in front of the pack, taking a look. Where do we want to go? Are we headed in the right direction? Do we even know where we want to go? Leaders have to be, and the Bhagavatam is to help bring out leadership. Like, you know, where are we going and how to get to where we're going? Do we know where we want to go? Bringing that thoughtfulness out. In a society that's very much influenced by the age of Kali, where specifically, explicitly, one is not encouraged to think like that. Just be productive. Be a cog in the machine of the gross national product. Go out and earn. Make a lot of money. Spend a lot of money. Be happy. Be productive. Be successful. Don't think about where you're going. What are the implications of how you're doing? Don't think like that. Just produce. More. Faster. Better. You'll get rewarded. Don't go over there. So the Bhagavatam wants to, you know, is for persons who are ready to keep going, but I want to know where I'm going. And why I should want to go there. I don't want people thinking for me. I want to think. And be convinced in my heart. Because when I'm convinced in my heart, then nothing's going to stop me. And that's leadership. And it was someone who's thinking clearly, and from that thinking clearly, speaking clearly, there are going to be people that are going to say, "Hey, you're right. Let's think clearly and." Let's go there. We can continue living our life fruitfully, but let's have the light on inside. So this is another reason why, a very important reason why understanding the process of creation is important. It is a different model than the mechanistic model. The model still involves energies. and the push and pull, the cause and effect of energies. Even Prabhupada is explaining here great controlling personalities in the universe. They know about these energies. They're using them. They're controlling these energies. And even they are bewildered about where the energies come from, how the whole thing works, the cause of creation. They have a better understanding than we do, but even they become bewildered. Brahma and Shiva, and what to speak of other demigods, are bhutas, or powerful, created demigods who manage universal affairs. To manage universal affairs, they got to understand the subtleties of push and pull, cause and effect of matter, much better than we do. And they do. And they're, because they're using those laws to control all kinds of stuff. Much like ministers appointed by a king. The ministers may be Ishwaras or controllers, but the Supreme Lord is Maheshwara, or the creator of the controllers. Persons with a forefront of knowledge do not know this, and therefore they have the audacity to deride him because he comes before us by his causeless mercy occasionally as a human being. So, before we get to the 10th canto, let's understand the 2nd canto. Because persons that hear about the pastimes of Krishna and the ways that he exhibits his energies in fantastic ways are going to go, oh, that's silly. Because they haven't understood how he's using his energies right in front of our nose in ways that are marvelous and very clear, very cogent, very compelling in a much different way than mechanistic science. So it would be wonderful to have a few devotee geniuses moving around the planet that could understand how things work and demonstrate, and by the quality of their life and by their astute understanding of the process of creation, this is how it works. It'd be a different world. But, you know, if you didn't have geniuses, just like clear, strong devotees, it still would be a different world. Minus that, we're heading in another direction. We're heading south. Quality of life is disappearing, like right before our eyes. You see it coming here to America. Doesn't take long. Just go to a classroom and watch how people behave. Wow. That's what's leading the world. Where are we going? More education, more faster, more control, more technology. Where are we going? Wait. Where are we going? Don't ask that question. Just perform. So this is to help us take a close look at observable things around us, you know, the creation, and how does it happen from the remote control. Okay, there's electrical energy. Where the electrical energy comes from? So the electrical power plant. Where's the intelligence of that person that knows how to make the electrical power plant and direct it? That's the engineer. Where'd the engineer get his education? Where's the professor he learned from? And keep going. What, you know, the intelligence of the intelligent, the controller of the controllers. Wishful thinking, or is it possible? Is it a reality to reach that, to connect with that source? Yes. The answer is yes. So the questions that Maharaj Pariksit is asking is probing in that direction. He wants to hear from Shukadeva Goswami about how it works so that he can appreciate better the person. So we just tag along behind Maharaj Pariksit and watch what happens. He might become thoughtful. text number 7, 8, and 9 from chapter 4. Text number 7. Kindly describe how the Supreme Lord, who is all-powerful, engages his different energies and different expansions in maintaining and again winding up the phenomenal world in the sporting spirit of a player, like a child. He doesn't give this explanation here, but elsewhere the same metaphor is used. Other metaphors are also used, like a child may spread out his toys, and in his little imagination world, he's, you know, doing something. People are coming in, people are going, people are having conversations, and then he just dismisses the toys, and it's over. Or another metaphor that's used is a spider, that from his own body he makes a web. And then he goes out on the web, moves around the web, does his thing for some time, and at his own will brings this web back into his own body. Because the web is just something that's come from his body. In a similar way, the child with his playthings, the sporting spirit of a player, or the spider. The spider example is very good because particularly the web itself comes from his own body, whereas the toys may come from the, you know, a toy store or something, some other source than himself. But in a playful spirit, Krishna is making this creation become manifest through the agency of his various energies. So the question is how? What's the process? How manifests, maintains, again winds up this phenomenal world? In the purport, Prabhupada is quoting Katha Upanishad, Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam Eko Bahunam Yogididati Kama. So, amongst so many eternals, there's one supreme eternal. Amongst all, he is maintaining everyone. Eko bohunam yo vidadati kaman. One is maintaining the plural. Eko bohunam yo vidadati kaman. So both in the liberated and the conditioned state, there's one that's maintaining all others. There's one, all beings are conscious, but there's one supreme conscious being amongst all that are conscious. And that one is maintaining the many. Very clear understanding. So now it's how. How does that happen? Such maintenance is affected by the Lord through his different expansions of capital S self, so personal expansions, or energetic expansions. Three categories: internal energy, marginal energy, material energy. Combinations, spiritual and material, everything is maintained. He also does through the agencies of others. He gives some of that potency to somebody. Okay, you take care of this. Okay, that's the demigods. Okay, you take care of that. That's what the devas are. Material creation is there. It's not just whimsical. Okay, there's material creation and he walks away. He maintained the material creation through the agency of those devas. Here's some potency, here's some ability, here's a plan. There you go. You have a lifetime worth of something to do. And their lifetime isn't the duration of the universe, so there are others that take the post. and continue. It is the succession of Manus. Each succession of Manus brings in a whole new administration, and they take over where the previous administration left off, and they maintain. And then Brahma's day ends. 100 Manus, okay, it's time for rest. And there's a partial annihilation, and everything is not maintained, because there's no devas to maintain it. Then again, next morning, okay, Manu, Swayambhu Manu, number one, go ahead, and so it goes. Then he got his administration, they get the empowerment. So that's like a high level, or like a, it gets much more detailed. The external energy, Maya, is also impregnated with the jivas, or conditioned souls, the unconditioned marginal potency, acts in the spiritual kingdom. And the Lord, by his different plenary expansions, maintains them in different transcendental relationships displayed in the spiritual sky. So, the one Supreme Personality of Godhead manifests himself in many, Bahusha, which is definitely misunderstood or differently understood by those that are not theists but are impersonalists. Bahusha, the one became many. So, you know this example. Here's a piece of paper. And supposing we ripped the piece of paper into little pieces and threw it out into the middle of the floor. The original piece of paper is gone. It's now little pieces of paper all over the floor. That's how they understand the Bahusham Vedic statement. One became many. And therefore, with that conception, you just put the many together and you're one again. But become one is the slogan. That means you become God. Cool. I always wanted to be God. Just, I'm God. And you're God too. And it's nice. We're back in the saddle. We're back in there. So, that's not the meaning. Meaning is, through expansions of self and expansions of energies, the Supreme One has now distributed himself throughout the whole of spiritual and material creation. Thus, all diversities are in him. All diversities are in him. He is in all diversities. Although he is nevertheless different from them, from all of them. Okay, we just got lost with that. Diversities are in him. The way to understand this is, you start with understanding that the Supreme Krishna, or this energetic source of all emanations, has many energies. And the energies are expanded because they are his energies. They are in him, and he is in them. There's this oneness between God and his energies. But then flips over the other way when the energetic and the energy are not 100% equal. We cannot say a spark is the fire. We cannot say a drop is the ocean. We cannot say the part is the whole. The part is part of the whole. It's qualitatively like the whole. It doesn't have anything that the whole doesn't have. So it's one with the whole. But at the same time, the energy is different from the energetic. So there's, like, Krishna's in the spiritual world, playing upon his flute and enjoying his pastimes with his eternal associates in Goloka Vrindavan, while everything that's in the temporarily manifest creation is an expansion of his energy. For that matter, in the spiritual world, is an expansion of his energies or his very self while he's enjoying his pastimes in the spiritual world. Prabhupada gives this worldly example, you've probably heard before. There's the industrialist and he's off in the golf course playing golf. Nothing happens in the factory except what he has authorized. Well, but he's just, you know, putting around in the golf course. It's all happening by his energy, and he has his own private life. Like that. Even in worldly things, what to speak of. In transcendental things, where not even a blade of grass moves without the sanction of Krishna, but he's not on circuit overload sanctioning every blade of grass. Every moment. And knowing the thoughts of every living being, and he's not... I want a break from being God for a while because it's too much. He's not limited. He's unlimited. He's unlimited. And everything material and spiritual emanates from him, therefore there's a direct connection. At the same time, he has his own transcendental, fully blissful spiritual existence. So there's this oneness and difference simultaneously between God and his energies, and not only God and his energies, even his expansions, even his plenary expansions. Everything, energy and personal expansions, spiritual, marginal, material energies and his personal expansions. This sublime philosophy of the Chinti Beda Beda Tashma. So it is the whole picture from the Bhagavad perspective. And Maharaj Parikshit is milking the cow. He's getting Shukadeva Goswami. Can you describe this? I want to understand how this is working. And his reason why he wants to understand how it is working is two verses later expressed, text number 9. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is one, whether he alone acts with the modes of material nature or simultaneously expands in many forms or expands consecutively to direct the modes of nature. So now, in the back up, there's a nice verse and a 2.5-page purport that fits in the middle of these two. O learned Brahmana, Maharaj Parikshit is addressing Shukadeva Goswami. The transcendental activities of the Lord are wonderful, and they appear inconceivable because even great endeavors by many learned scholars have proved insufficient for understanding them. They can understand something, cause and effect, and think, aha, and win a Nobel Prize. But to go beyond that cause and effect to the cause of that cause, of that effect, the transcendence cannot be approached by mental speculation, is the understanding here. However you stretch your mind, however powerful a mind you may have, put rocket fuel in your mind and you still cannot approach transcendence. However expert one may be as a Muni, the great thinker. Still we have to be thoughtful, but not propelled by mental speculation. So here's, it's by this process, Maharaj Parikshit is hearing from Shukadeva Goswami. The Surabhi cow is delivering beautiful purport. I'd like to read the whole thing. We have time. What's our time? 7:15.
How are we doing?
Huh?
Up to 7:30.
Okay. I'll read fast. No. The acts of the Supreme Lord in the creation of just this one universe appears inconceivably wonderful. And there are innumerable universes. And all of them aggregated together are known as the created material world. And this part of his creation is only a fractional portion of the complete creation. You know, the one quarter, three quarters found in the Purusha Sukta prayers. This realm is one quarter. The spiritual realm is three quarters. Same as in the Bhagavatam, in Purusha Sukta confirmed chapter, because it's explaining the Purusha Sukta prayers. Fantastic chapter. Supposing that the material world is a display of one part of his energy, the remaining three parts consist of the Vaikuntha Jagat, or the spiritual world, described in Bhagavad Gita as Mad Dhamma, or Sanatana Dhamma, or the eternal womb. We have marked in the previous verse that he creates and again winds up the creation. This action is applicable only in the material world, because the other, greater portion of his creation, namely the Vaikuntha world, is neither created nor annihilated. Otherwise, the Vaikuntha Dham would not have been called eternal. Like a lawyer building his case. The Lord exists with Dhamma. What's that? His eternal name, quality, pastimes, entourage, and personality are all the display of his different energies and expansions. The Lord is called Anadi, or having no creator, and Adi. That's pretty good. He's Adi and Anadi at the same time. That's really good. He's this and not this. He has no creator, and he is the creator. Like, there's a phrase the Prabhupada likes to use. Asamordva. The description of God is asama, there's no equal, nor is there urdva, someone greater. So like in numbers, he has his own category and the set is one. There's not another in that set. He's one. No equal and no greater. And there's only one in that category. He's the original, and he has no origin. He's the origin of everything, and he has no origin. Anadi Adi, golden, the Sarvakarana Karana. We think, in our own imperfect way, that the Lord is also created. But the Vedanta informs us that he is not created. Rather, everything else is created by him, Narayana Parovyaktat. Therefore, for the common man, these are all very wonderful matters for consideration. Even for great scholars, they are inconceivable, and thus such scholar presents theories contradictory to one another. Even for the insignificant part of his creation, this particular universe, they have no complete information as to how far this limited space extends, or how many stars and planets are there, or the different conditions of those innumerable planets. Modern scientists have insufficient knowledge of all this. Some of them assert that there are 100 million planets scattered all over space. In a news release from Moscow, this is old, dated 2/11/2/21/60, the following piece of knowledge was relayed. Quote,
Russia's well-known professor of astronomy, Boris Voronstov, something or other, said that there must be an infinite number of planets in the universe inhabited by beings endowed with reason. It could be that life similar to that on Earth flourishes on such planets. Doctor of Chemistry, Nikolat Zhirov, covering the problem of atmosphere on other planets, pointed out that the organism of a Martian, for instance, could very well adapt itself to normal existence with a low body temperature. He said that he felt that the gaseous composition of Martian atmosphere was quite suitable to sustain life of beings which have become adapted to it. So, right in the Bhagavatam. Paragraph. This adaptability of an organism to different varieties of planets is described in Brahma Samhita as vibhuti bhinam. Vibhuti is opulence, like the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita's Vibhuti Yoga, the opulence of the Absolute. Vibhuti bhinam, different or various or separated energies. So the adaptability of living entities is vibhuti bhinam. They have this capacity to, in different environments, adapt. Of course, scientists readily accept that, even today, not just Nikolov Zhirov. There's adaptability. There's limits. That is, each and every one of the innumerable planets within the universe is endowed with a particular type of atmosphere, and the living beings there are more perfectly advanced in science and psychology because of a better atmosphere. Vibhuti means specific powers, and bhinam means variegated. Scientists who are attempting to explore outer space and are trying to reach other planets by mechanical arrangements must know for certain that organisms adapted to the atmosphere of of Earth cannot exist in the atmospheres of other planets. See Easy Journey to Other Planets. Prabhupada wrote this before he came to America in the late 60s. He doesn't have a science degree, but he's a professor of Bhagavatam, and based upon that knowledge, what modern scientists are speculating about over there, then he's making statements. There's this adaptability is within the Vedas. There's different atmospheres, and you can't, with this body, if there's a limit. We can't adapt to that, but, you know, there's adaptability. Because we can't do it doesn't mean other living entities can't do it. And in fact, the Vedas confirm, sarvagata, living entities are everywhere. One has to prepare himself, therefore, to be transferred to a different planet after being relieved of the present body, as it is said in the Bhagavad Gita, 9:25. Yanti deva vata devan pitran yanti pitra vataha bhutani yanti bhuteja yanti mam yajino bhimam. We can go to different places depending upon our process of worship. Almost done. Marsh Pixit's statement regarding the workings of the creative energy of the Lord discloses that he knew everything of the process of creation. Why then did he ask Shukadeva Goswami for such information? Marsh Pixit, being a great emperor, a descendant of the Pandavas, and a great devotee of Lord Krishna, was quite able to know considerably about the creation of the world. But that much knowledge was not sufficient. He said, therefore, that even greatly learned scholars fail to know about that. Even after great effort, the Lord is unlimited, and his activities are also unfathomed. With a limited source of knowledge and with imperfect senses, any living being up to the standard of Brahmaji, the highest perfect living being within the universe, can never imagine knowing about the unlimited. There's a verse in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto where Brahma says, some people say they know all about you. We've certainly heard that. My dear sir, please take this Bhagavad Gita. Oh, I know all about Krishna. So even Brahma said this so long ago. Some people say they know all about you. They may say like that, that's okay. As for myself, I'm supposed to be the most learned person in the whole universe, and I can say, I don't know the first thing of your transcendental glories, and there's no limit to you. So, even Maharaj Parikshit understood greatly, not just he wanted more information, he wanted to more deeply understand, more completely experience that which he had some information about through the medium of association with Shukadeva Goswami. We can know something of the unlimited when it is explained by the unlimited, as has been done by the Lord himself in the unique statements of the Bhagavad Gita, and it can be known to some extent from realized souls like Shukadeva Goswami, who learned it from Vyas, the disciple of Narada, and thus the perfect knowledge can descend by the chain of disciplic succession only, and not by any form of experimental knowledge, old or modern. To be continued at 7:30. Maharaj Parikshit is going to take us to Krishna's lotus feet. Watch. So, you have classes to attend.
Yeah? My question?
Yeah.
One of the reasons that people are so afraid of bringing in religious concepts into educational systems is because mostly people disagree, even the religionists. They don't have a common view. They may have a view that there's a creator, but then the varieties of understanding, many of which are misconceptions. And therefore, how would you systematically introduce teaching something like Bhagavatam in academic curriculum? Because the whole reason why the church was separated from the state was because of the misuse of
the commingling of authority, the government people mingling the authority of the church in order to rule the people just for pragmatic purposes, and that corrupting the church and that corrupting the political leaders. That's at least, you know, the European version of why separation of church and state.
Suppose right now we were given that facility, even ISKCON society. I think to get a uniform picture of what is the right thing to be taught and nurtured would be very difficult to get.
Well, something that Prabhupada said about this on the point of a secular state was the duty of the government is not to select for the people, you must take this version, but rather the duty of a secular government is that you're Muslim, you should follow this. You're Christian, you should follow Christian. You're Buddhist, you should follow Buddhist. You're so not following and not at all monitoring is not the duty of the secular state. And you know, the person the Prabhupada was speaking with was, oh, Swamiji. No, scientists don't like, and politicians also don't like, because it gets really messy, because people get really emotionally invested in their version. So, you know, which is the right Christian version? Which is the right Islamic version? Which is the right Hindu version? You know, you're going to have
so many different positions on that. So therefore they don't touch it. At least your question is how to introduce something systematic. And there's not an easy way to do it, but at least thoughtful persons, you know, just as you're doing, thoughtful persons need to at least be provided an opportunity to understand very carefully the Vedic version, and then let them choose, like Krishna does with Arjuna. I've explained all this, now you decide what you feel is best for you to do. So it's not a mandated version, but it's a version that thoughtful persons should consider. The appeal is at least consider. So, in response to your question, I don't find that the shortage, the main shortage is finding thoughtful persons, both as presenters and as audiences. But the more that there are thoughtful presenters, I think we'll find more and more thoughtful audiences. Or say the same thing in a different way. Promotion of ecumenical culture is essential. And where there's light, light displaces darkness. I mean, there are always people that are going to want darkness. Even if light is available, they'll find darkness. But light will displace darkness. It's something that's genuine is appealing, especially when it gives genuine happiness and genuine satisfaction. What to speak of relief from distress, you know, the distress of being in ignorance. While it's always going to be the case, some people want to remain in ignorance. It's not something that you can mandate or legislate. It's something that one can propagate. So the Vedic model needs to be clearly understood. There's a number of devotees that are very, very bright, brilliant, I should say, that are working very hard over a number of years on Vedic planetarium. Now there's a lot of ideas from other traditions on, you know, Vedic cosmology. And very, you know, deep personalities working on it have been, so they're being consulted, and so to get one Vedic planetarium model that all of those that invested time in Vedic, just even Vedic cosmology, that'll be a challenge, because there are always going to be people who say, no, it's not like that, it's like this. Or at least some piece of it. But, so that's a part response to your question. You get one picture that people will buy into. Not likely. But at least something that's, from very elevated souls and presented in the like Prabhupada's Bhagavatam, Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. It was just hearing from a devotee from Mid Tennessee who was visiting in Chicago some relatives, and he went to some temple, a new temple, Hindu Mandir of Grays Lake, Illinois, and they don't have any teaching. So, but they do have a person giving a Bhagavad Gita class, and he asked them, "Oh, can I see the Bhagavad Gita that you're using?" And it was Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. And why do you, you know? He just innocently asked, you know, why do you? Because it's so clear. So something that's presented very clearly even they may not be strict sadhakas and so forth, but something that's clear is clear. And the more that there's the training from someone who understands it clearly to those that have yet to understand it, the better. The more clear it will become, even to those who think it's clear. So, my answer is promotion for the Nipple culture. That's how genuine medical culture, when that's promoted, then an acceptable understanding will be available, and people will be attracted. Say it the other way around. For lack of proper medical culture, there's a zillion ideas out there, ever expanding. Like Prabhupada's comment about the falling apart of the Gaudiya Math, the work that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur did built the prominence in India of the teachings of Lord Chaitanya to such a level that because his immediate followers didn't follow his example and they started, you know, quarreling over properties and stuff and stopped the preaching, then for that period of time the teachings of Lord Chaitanya subsided and Ramakrishna Mission became very popular in place. Now, the preaching is carrying on very strongly and in India, ISKCON is very prominent. Everybody knows what, you know, they may like or not like, but they all know. And largely it's like. It has at least a great deal of respect and credibility. So that's a platform for presenting the Vedic conclusion to a class of thoughtful people. So that means promotion of the medical culture within that respectability. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta did even without the respectability, so what to speak of with. And here in the West, people know nothing about nothing, and you know but in one sense that's helpful because they don't have a preconception. They can, well, this is, but because of the lack of strong presentation of Vedic wisdom, what's coming to people that have a spiritual inclination is really wishy-washy milk toast. So then, you know, when they hear Bhagavad Gita as it is, they hear through that filter. It takes a while. That's not really what the message is. It's not milk toast. Okay, we're past time. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada, 15:09.